back in the day when there was like a lot of, I guess it was earlier internet, where there were all these like group chats you could get into. And it was, you know, a chat that would be going on and you'd be trying to put your words in, your statement in, and then the whole chat would just continue on without you because you weren't able to contribute fast enough. That's my experience of X.
Hey folks, welcome to Executive Runtime. Here, we speak with highly accomplished executives to hear about their stories, lessons learned, and frameworks used to reach the highest levels of leadership and success. I'm your host, Johnny Austin. Without further ado, let's jump right into it. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Lucia Guillory, Chief People Officer at Virta Health, and a fascinating example of someone who successfully bridged the worlds of academia and corporate leadership. Lucia brings a unique background as an escaped academic with a PhD in organizational behavior from Stanford's Graduate School of Business. Her research on power dynamics, organizational networks, and leadership have been published in prestigious psychology journals, and she's now applying these evidence-based principles in her executive role. Her career path has taken her from Yahoo, where she led global employee engagement and analytical initiatives, to Patreon as head of people, and now to Virta Health, where she's been for 6 years and currently serves as Chief People Officer. What makes Lucia's perspective particularly valuable is her focus on designing self-reinforcing systems that measure and improve culture and performance, combined with her data-driven approach to leadership development. She describes her leadership style as grounded in authenticity, inquiry, and connection, using storytelling to help teams transform aspirations into meaningful outcomes. Lucia's journey offers a masterclass in combining analytical thinking with human-centered leadership. So, without further delay, let's welcome Dr. Lucia Guillory to the show. Lucia, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jumping right into it, I was doing research for this episode, and I noticed that you're a pretty prolific LinkedIn poster. And something I've noticed recently, the world separates itself into two groups of people, the people who are really into LinkedIn and leverage it and post and do all this other stuff. And then there are people who just make fun of the platform because it's just professionals. I don't know what the criticism is really, but I just find it fascinating. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on leveraging LinkedIn or maybe similar other platforms as a tool to talk about things in your industry? I'm trying to avoid using the term thought leader, but it's unavoidable. Doing the thought leadery things and really trying to establish yourself as an expert in your field or just, you know, just talking about things that are relevant. Has that been a tool that you've been using, or is this something that you just enjoy doing?
Yeah. Oh, I'm a recent LinkedIner. I used to not post on LinkedIn. I've only recently started, and I started, I would say, more because I wanted community than thought leadership. I wanted to meet other people in the people space. My company's been growing really rapidly, and there are new challenges that I'm facing. And so I wanted to be able to connect with leaders who are at a similar stage and hear what they were doing, see what was going on. And through LinkedIn, I've made a number of connections that I've actually been able to manifest in person. And that's been pretty nice to go and meet somebody and talk to them about what they're doing. So that's kind of been my experience with it. But I know everyone's journey is different there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting platform. Sometimes I don't know what it wants to be. First of all, I'm a LinkedIn apologist. I just want to put that out there. I really like the platform. But, you know, it's like, is it a job board? Is it a place to talk about your professional experience? Is it just a place to put your profile? I mean, the answer is all of the above, but it's always interesting to see how different people leverage the platform. Some people use it begrudgingly, right? They get on there when they want to find a job, but then that's it. Then they'll abandon the platform for a few years. So I was just curious on your thoughts on that, especially since sometimes people will ask me for advice and then I'll go to their LinkedIn and I'll just be like, I don't know what you want me to say, right? If I'm a recruiter looking to hire someone, you don't have a profile picture. I have no idea what you really do. How do you expect people to find you? And usually the retort will be something like, well, I look for jobs on Twitter or X or whatever.
Oh, and, really? Interesting.
Well, I don't know. Maybe once upon a time, I think that was, I think that's a thing today, but I think what they really mean is they go there for more authentic connections. But I've seen the discourse on X. I think people need to really be careful about whose advice they take, because you have people on there who are like, you don't need LinkedIn. That's lame. You can get a job here on X. But like, these people already have 500,000 followers. Everything they say and do is going to be visible to their particular network, or they're independently wealthy. And so they don't actually need to find a job. And so I think that the advice that people are actually listening to is maybe not consistent with the reality of their situation.
I would say so, at least for me. I personally find X overwhelming. I have gone on and off X, Twitter, what have you, many a time. And the main issue for me is the opportunity to consume is too intense. And I just feel constant FOMO whenever I'm on there, because I feel like every second, it's kind of like back in the day when there was like a lot of, I guess it was earlier internet, where there were all these like group chats you could get into. And it was, you know, a chat that would be going on and you'd be trying to put your words in, your statement in, and then the whole chat would just continue on without you because you weren't able to contribute fast enough. That's my experience of X. So I definitely don't conceptualize it as a place to go to look for jobs. I would say it's interesting to observe others having their dialogue and to see what they are doing, but not to, at least not for me to engage. I'm pretty busy and don't have the opportunity to engage on the frequency to be able to have a conversation there. However, what I would say about LinkedIn is that I have a lot of openings right now, which is another reason why I'm on LinkedIn often, because I'm posting about the openings. But I do look at the LinkedIn profiles. And I would say I look at the LinkedIn profiles much more than I look at the actual resumes, because I find it easier to consume the information about the person on LinkedIn than in the stagnant mechanism of the resume. I would also say I look at what they have posted about to try and understand what interests them, what kind of orientation they'll have when they come into the role. And you can't typically get that from a resume. So at least for me in my hiring flow, it's important. And with the agencies that I work with, which is a number of different recruiting agencies over time, they are also leveraging LinkedIn. You know, definitely to source, we leverage it to source. And so the probability of being sourced by an agency through your resume seems quite low. And the probability of being hired from submitting a resume without a LinkedIn seems to me to be reasonably low as well. Not that you can't do it, but you're definitely going to have a much greater chance with a LinkedIn. And a LinkedIn that is active and up to date.
Yep. I hope our listeners are paying attention. It's not just me saying this. You have a couple people who are responsible for hiring. It's really important to maintain those profiles. And I think one of the other comparisons is people don't find the platform fun. It's like, oh, it's boring, but it's not really a toy. It's a tool for you to use to achieve a goal. So hopefully people will take something away from that, how to actually engage with the platform and why it's really important. Jumping into your educational foundations, can you tell me a little bit about your background going through your educational journey and then kind of jumping into academia, and how has it helped kind of prepare you for your current, but also maybe future roles?
Yeah, I've always been interested in psychology. I did an undergrad in psych, and at that point in my life, I was thinking about going into clinical psych, but I did some internships that set me on a different path. I found that clinical psych was, I guess, it did not produce the opportunity for change that I would have wanted. So I found that was probably my first foray into healthcare. And
can you say why? I'm not really familiar with clinical psych.
So I mean, my internship was in a psych ward, and it was a government-funded psych ward, and essentially people were on rotation. You know, they were brought in, they were given drugs, they were then released back onto the street, and then they would invariably, like, run out of access to those drugs, and they would just be brought back. And they'd either be brought back to the psych ward or they'd be put in jail or in prison for whatever crimes they committed while they were out. And it just seemed like a really vicious cycle. No one was getting better. There was no orientation around true healing. And when thinking about going into that space, I was not encouraged and motivated by that. I was more discouraged. And I was like, this whole system, the whole infrastructure is oriented around medicating folks and you know, pushing them back into the street and going back and doing that again, you know, 8-10 times. And so 8-10 times. And so, you know, that wasn't appealing to me, but it did get me interested. And I think like appeared later on in my life in the context of my current role in healthcare. It got me thinking about systems and why they work and don't work and our dependence on medication and how that can detract from efforts to leverage other means of driving change like cognitive behavioral therapy and whatnot. So that experience with clinical psychology led me to think, okay, well, I don't want to go into clinical psych. I don't want to become a psychiatrist, which was what I was thinking about in terms of the clinical approach. But I do recognize that people spend a lot of their time at work, and maybe I could find out how to help people through their work life since it's such a big part of life in general. I want to learn more about organizational behavior. And that research I started doing in undergrad is what helped open the door to going to Stanford and doing a PhD in organizational behavior. And so that's kind of the educational trajectory that I was on. And I would say at Stanford, I still experienced some of the challenges that I experienced in my first kind of career shift, in that I wanted to have impact. And I was really concerned that staying within academia would limit that impact, because most of the parties that were consuming my research would have already known about my research because they were doing research in the same space. There was just limited impact, limited exposure. And that's what led me to go Applied, is that I wanted to be able to do more large scale interventions and have more impact.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were really wanting to focus more on like the healing aspect and less on the treatment medication standpoint. Not that medication doesn't have its place. It obviously does. I'm curious on what you think is at its core. Is that, you know, something that is an effect of like the pharmaceutical companies and how, you know, they make a profit, not to put on a tinfoil hat or anything, but yeah. Is it the practice itself? Or I'm curious on just your take.
I think it's hard to say, you know, from being within a system or observing a system, it's easy to recognize how it is failing, but it's harder to come with solutions. Were I to try and propose solutions, I would say for the vast majority of mental health challenges, you've got to have some co-therapy element, right? Like if you're prescribing a drug, that shouldn't be the only action that's taken to address whatever the issue is at hand. There needs to be support in a conversation, at the very least, with the person so that they can understand what they would need to change and modify about their lifestyle such that they can navigate their illness. And then with the family and the community of those folks, helping them understand what they need to do, how they can help. You know, and I think without having a more holistic approach that includes deeply understanding that person's support system and trying to help them be a support, it's going to be difficult to see any type of intervention work in the long term. I would say the other thing I observed is that the time window of care was too limited. You know, someone would come in, their situation would be urgent, they would be given a medication, and then they would be sent away, you know, within 2-3 days. If you have a life-threatening mental illness, 2-3 days of observation and medication is unlikely to be a lasting solution. And I would say that that short stint, the severity of the issue, the lack of community support, all of those things, plus I would say the criminalization of mental health issues, which is its own issue, were all coming together and just making it an unsuccessful approach, you know?
Yep. Makes sense. So you were at Yahoo for a bit. Can you talk about your time there, especially, I guess you had work in predictive analytics, but you were chief of staff to the head of HR. How did these positions help shape your approach to leadership?
I definitely feel really grateful for the time that I had at Yahoo because I got to do so many different jobs as a person who had no experience or skill in any job. We're like, oh, you want to do that? Well, you did pretty well at the previous thing. We'll allow it. You know, so I did three different jobs while there. And in some of the jobs I actually did concurrently, which was interesting and fun to be able to do as someone who's fresh out of grad school. So, I mean, which of them would you like for me to tell you about?
I was going to say, which jobs are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, I did the analytics job first. Okay. And then while doing the analytics job, I'm not sure what the order is now because I did four different jobs. So I did the analytics job. I did employee engagement, kind of led that program. I was chief of staff. And then I also did business partnership for the commercial team. And three of those things I did concurrently. You know, rolling into one, rolling off of another.
Yeah, I don't think I was aware of the actual employee engagement one. I'm curious about, you know, what led you into that role? And you said you were doing some of this stuff concurrently. First of all, like, how did that happen? But in terms of employee engagement, you know, how did you approach that role? Like, what did success look like? Were you successful in that role? Or did you take away any lessons?
Well, definitely in terms of doing more than one job concurrently, I would recommend it to anyone. And I think particularly folks who are early on in their career, I don't think you should do more than one job concurrently at different organizations. Don't do that. Or at least don't do that without talking to your organization about it. But I would say if you see work that exists to be done that interests you, offering to do that work is always a good thing in that it gives you more exposure, more opportunity for learning. And it also increases your likelihood of being seen as someone who is a great candidate for promotion because you're already demonstrating that you can have more scope than you were initially hired to have. And so for me, at that point in my life and career, and I would say this is still a quality that I have, I really want to have more impact. You can probably tell from the decisions I've made, like having more impact is really important to me and it motivates me and drives me. And so as someone who was doing analytics, I was like, oh, analytics is fun. I understand this. I was doing this as a grad student, but I am not finding a way to connect my observations and my research to the actions that the business is taking. I want those two things to be more linked. And one avenue that I saw for that was, well, engagement is something that the whole company is reporting on. It is quantitative. I am quantitative. I could go and own that. And then that is a way I can, you know, get my ideas integrated into the action plans of these leaders. So, you know, it was a looking for an opportunity to have more impact and adding something to your scope, to your expectations, that was on my mind there. And then similarly, in thinking about the chief of staff role or the role with regards to the commercial team, there's a certain orientation around, well, what would be the next step? So the next step from giving the broader company guidance or advice on what to do, given these quantitative engagement results, is being the business partner for the largest function and trying to help that function take this advice and manifest it with the business leaders. So my advice would be, one, like, always look for additional scope and always try and stretch for that scope if you can. And then try and get closer to the decision, because that's where the impact is. The further away you are from the actual decision, oftentimes less impact. But as you move, you also want to be moving closer to where the decision is being made.
Yeah. When you're seeking out that additional scope, I agree, by the way, would you say it's better to simply jump in and help solve those problems and address it? Or do you talk to your boss first, ask for permission, that sort of thing? I mean, what's your approach to kind of expanding your scope on the job?
Well, I think you definitely have to have a strong understanding of your own role and be delivering in your own role well. Like, don't try and do something else if you're not good at the core thing that you were there to do. And when you're really good at your job and you're putting that first, you typically would have a good relationship with your boss. So I never took something on that my manager didn't know about. And I had a number of different managers while there as well, because in some cases, my role changed and I needed to go to a different manager. And so I would say having a good relationship with your manager and also the other leaders in the space is going to be critical to your success, so that it's not some dramatic or unspoken thing when you shift from task to task or team to team. The other thing I would say is don't focus on the money. So I never said, oh, I'm going to take this on and now you need to pay me more. I have two jobs now, pay me twice as much. You know, what I said was, I really want to have more impact. I see this opportunity. I could be doing so many more things for the company. Like, can I do them? And I was given those opportunities, and then the money came, you know, after that. I do think that sometimes people put the cart before the horse before they even deliver the additional value. They want to talk about the new role that they're going to get. And you're just in a position of weakness in terms of your bargaining power when you start trying to negotiate and you haven't delivered anything.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the money piece. One of the big retorts I often see to other people making the same point you made about being proactive and trying to expand your scope was that I need to get paid more, right? Like, I'm not going to go do extra work without getting paid extra money. And that does seem a bit short-sighted if you're trying to actually grow within your career, right? There's another career path where you just settle in, you do your 9-to-5, you clock in, you clock out, and you're kind of okay coasting. I think that's a choice that someone can make. I don't think that's our listeners at large, people who want to actually grow within their career, people who are a bit more ambitious. And for those people, I 100% agree with you, right? Looking for that additional scope, obviously being strategic about what you're actually taking on is really important. And you're 100% right. Like, the money will come, particularly if you're early on in your career, right? One of the worst things you can do is optimize for money earlier in your career. Because it's just the wrong optimization path. That stuff really comes a little bit later. And missing on like the high impact things are the best way to actually get there.
I'd also say someone will pay you. It may not be the company that you're at the moment when you develop the additional skills, but those skills are yours once you develop them. And that experience is yours once you develop them. And no one can take that from you. And if the company that you're at, where you are delivering so much beyond your scope, isn't willing to pay you, there's definitely another company right around the corner that is willing to. And so I always encourage my teammates to think about what they decide to do at work, not in terms of the organization that we're in at this moment exclusively, but in terms of what is the profile that you want to have as someone who works in this space over time, and can you produce that here? And we'll think about whether you can have the title and the compensation and the level here or not. And I think that it may be that you can, maybe that you can't. There may not be a business need for that. But if you're ready to step into that role, I think that that is the ideal position to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Talking about career turning points, I'm curious on how you view risks during your career, right? Could you talk about maybe a time where you took a calculated risk that paid off, or maybe one that didn't pay off so well? I'm curious if you have any of those insights.
Well, what is paid off? You know, I think
you have to define that.
You do. Yeah, you do what you do with your career and you hope for the best. And it's impossible to know how alternate realities would have transpired or what would have occurred. I would say going from Yahoo, which was 15,000, to Patreon, which was 60, was a big risk and a big jump for me. And that this stability that I had in my job at Yahoo was far and away, you know, a different reality from going into Patreon, not really knowing, was this company going to continue to exist for the full year that I was there? I was responsible for all the parts of the people function, the person responsible, as opposed to being the assistant to the person responsible, which is a very different job. Like being the hand of the king is really different from being the person, you know? So there are a lot of risks involved in that decision. I'm happy with what I did and how it went. Was it the best possible thing? Who knows?
That's a good segue into your time at Patreon. How do you make that transition and then go into at the time, a much smaller organization and kind of establish yourself as a new leader, especially now that, to your point, like you're now the person? You know, how did you feel? Did you feel confident in your ability to pull it off? Or I'm just curious on what was going through your head at that time.
Yeah, I definitely did not feel confident. I would say confidence is something that I have been working on as a person for many, many years. And I work on that with my coach and I work on that with my therapist, but I definitely didn't feel confident. I felt hopeful. I was really excited for the opportunity to build something. I love being able to create systems and processes and think deeply about the employee as a customer and the customer experience. And I was excited by, as I shared earlier, this getting closer to the decision, like being at the point of the decision finally. I was excited about that and all of the things I could build, I could learn. And I also really love the mission. I feel like creating and facilitating the creation of others is something that I'm deeply passionate about. And so all of those things came together to make me feel afraid and excited at the same time.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally natural. Totally natural. You mentioned coaching and therapy. Depending on who you talk to, either coaching is right for them, it's not right for them. Some people love it. Some people don't think it's worth it. I'm curious on how big of a role has coaching in particular, but also therapy is important, played in your career success? Has it given you the right tools to make the right decisions? Or how does that play out on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think that they've both been crucial. I've had different types of coaches as well throughout my career. I've had coaches that are more traditional leadership coaches. So they're providing guidance on elements of leadership and are more theoretical in nature. So they're trying to help you develop core competencies. And I've also had coaching that was more oriented around subject matter expertise. So helping you understand your field because they've worked in your field and have a depth of understanding there that they can convey and kind of see around corners for you. And I'd say both, you know, both are good. The most important thing, though, is having a strong relationship with your coach and trusting them to have your back and have your best interest at heart. Because I think that that's a thing that a lot of people are lacking broadly in life and in the world. But I would say particularly lacking in the experience of leadership, because you've got all of these decisions that you're supposed to be making and challenges that you're facing. But in many cases, you're not in a position to discuss them with the people that report to you. And at least in my role, I'm often also not in a position to discuss them with my peers because they have to remain confidential. And so it's difficult to have all of that on your heart, on your chest, and not have any kind of outlet. And I feel like coaches often help with that. And I would say therapists are also a great help for that, doing the inner work that's necessary to be able to create space and time for other people's needs and concerns and issues, which is basically what management is. It's like helping people through their inner work in a lot of senses.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about leadership until they actually get there is it can be pretty isolating and lonely for the reasons you talked about, right? Obviously, being within HR, there's an extra layer to it. But I think for all leaders, particularly the higher you go, you have fewer and fewer peers, and you just don't have many people who can relate to the challenges you're facing on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, there are different ways to address this. I see, you know, groups that get together and they kind of talk to each other, and that can be very helpful. But I mean, that's a once in a few months sort of situation. But for the most part, it can be super isolating and hard to deal with. And maybe that's where therapy comes in as well. That gives you an additional outlet, not to necessarily discuss your day to day, but just to give you someone who is non-judgmental, has no biases about your day-to-day job. They don't know the people you work with, but someone who you can help, who you can blow steam with, just to get that weight off of your shoulders.
I totally agree. I think that self-reflection is a critical element of the human experience. And the more people you're interfacing with and the more impact you have on their lives, the more important it is that you can hold a mirror to yourself and really think deeply about the way you're showing up. And therapists have that as a superpower. They're definitely extremely skilled at that, and they do that all the time as their core job. And I found that really beneficial, at least in the therapists that I've had, to have someone who can do that with me and who I also feel more comfortable doing that with than I would say I do with even family and friends, because I don't want to burden them, and everyone has different roles that they play with their family and friends, you know? And I would say I play more of the role of the, how would I describe it? I am bringing the calm and the stability and consistency. And so to be the person that's like, and I'm falling apart, you know? It does not feel like the role that I play. And so it's definitely harder for me to do that in these settings that are also available. But the setting with a therapist where we know what this relationship is, it is a therapeutic relationship, I feel much more comfortable being more deeply vulnerable, and vulnerable to a point where my deeper fears are revealed than in these other relationships where I feel like I need to be the rock.
Wow, you really hit on something. I probably need to see a therapist because I have some of the same challenges in terms of my role with my family, not just my immediate family, but extended family, folks that I only see like once a year, once every couple of years. It's like, I'm the person, like I'm the rock. I'm the person that everyone else goes to for everything. And so having someone to just talk to who is not part of that unit seems like really helpful. So I don't know, something to think about for myself.
I would recommend it.
Yeah.
I have a therapist and a coach. That is my approach. That's my MO.
Yeah. Transitioning to healthcare innovation, we kind of touched a little bit on it earlier, but what drew you to Verta Health in 2019, and how did you adapt your expertise to the healthcare sector, and what unique challenges do you think it presented?
Yeah, I wasn't particularly passionate about healthcare, nor did I think that I was going to be working in healthcare, because I had worked at a media company, and then I had worked at what is essentially a payments platform, but the reason why people joined was not because they cared about payments, it was because they cared about creators. And I would say similarly, when joining Verta, I wasn't interested in moving into healthcare or had any plans with regards to healthcare. I honestly found out about Verta because I received this outreach about a company that reversed diabetes, and that seemed illogical to me and like false advertising, and being the kind of nerd data weirdo that I am, I was like, this is not factual. There is lots of research suggesting that this does not happen with regards to this disease. You need to reflect upon this and not engage in false advertising. And that opened up this discourse about whether this was in fact possible. And they were sending me research. And I was, you know, reading through that in comparison to other research that had been done. And the long story short is that it is possible. And that's something that I could not fathom at that time. I have a very strong family history of diabetes. My dad's a 20 plus year diabetic who's actually paralyzed as a result of the degrading of his body and health from the disease and from having it so long. And so I wanted to be a part of seeing the disease eradicated. I feel like it is horrible. If you are exposed to people who have diabetes, you would agree that it's a debilitating disease. And if there's a way to avoid it, you would want to, and you would want those that you love to. And when I think about the fact that we as individuals can stop this from occurring, it's mind-blowing, and it was definitely something I wanted to be a part of. So,
you talked a little bit earlier, kind of running HR, not quite as a product. This is something we talked about in our intro meeting, but thinking about people as, I don't know, customers, or as, I don't want to say customers, that's the wrong term. Basically, how does HR as a product function in your mind, right? What changes do you think are required in order to kind of shape the function in such a way that it serves the people it's supposed to serve in a much more effective manner, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I understand the link that you're making with customers, in that oftentimes people conceptualize, you know, a product as having a product and then it's got a user or a customer. And I would say one of the core tenets that you see manifested in product management is around understanding what that user's problem is, or the potential user's problem is, like deeply understanding that problem and then building potential solutions for that problem, as opposed to thinking about, well, what is a great product that we want to produce and what elements would it have? You know, and so I would say at the first level, that holds true on the people side as well, which is, what is the person, the teammate trying to experience, whether it be onboarding, they're trying to become a part of an organization, they want to have a relationship with their manager, they want to understand their role, they want to feel like they're part of a team. So starting with what is the problem that the end user is having, deeply understanding that problem, and then trying to build for that problem, I would say is a core tenet that is true across people function, or should be true across the people function and across product and product delivery. I feel like a lot of times in the people function, we suffer from the same fate that sometimes keeps products from being great, which is we're so focused on the back end and what we need, what documents we need to have, and so on and so forth, that there's a lot of instrumentation that's produced that does not actually improve the employee experience. And so one of the things that we have done at Virta to help with that is that we actually do a launch party that happens every quarter, where we talk about all the things that we launched that were improvements to the employee experience, and we share them with the entire company. And I think it serves two purposes. One, it helps people understand, like, what are the features, what are the offerings, how is this product working and improving? But for us, it focuses us on the experience of the employee. Like, we need to be doing work that is going to change the employee's experience, because that's what we are talking about. That's what this is about, you know, as opposed to we have become more compliant in XYZ. Not that that's not great and important, like, we should definitely do that work. But if the employee is not going to actually experience it, it is not the number one priority, because that's what this organization, this product is designed to do. It is designed to enhance the employee experience. And as a result, performance and all of these things to make the business better and more effective. So I'd say that's the first piece, is like really focusing on the problem. Other elements that are consistent, rapid iteration is definitely a consistent piece. Being focused on what's going to be measured and understanding the impact of what the work is, or other points of consistency between like building a product and running a people function, for sure.
That's pretty interesting. Cool. We're running up on time already, but one last thing I wanted to ask you about is work-life balance. What role do you think, and there are a lot of different phrases for it, work-life balance, work-life harmony and whatnot. What role does that play in a career like yours, where you're very ambitious, you're taking on a lot, growing as a leader? Do you think that there is a such thing as balance? How do you think about it?
Well, I think if you want to have a great career, you want to be successful at what you do, you should be doing something that you really want to do, you're really excited to do. And that was something that, that concept was something I struggled with for sure growing up, and even as a more early stage career person, in that, you know, I have a lot of responsibilities and I have expenses and I have XYZ, and I was more, I would say, more focused on career for career earlier on than I am now. And the idea of thinking through what do you like to do and making sure you do that just did not compute for me, but it's making more sense as I move along in this process. And I think if you really enjoy what you're doing, you do experience a dichotomy, but it's not as stark. It's not, this is my work time, this is my not work time. Like I really love analyzing data, and I will do that during my free time. I really love using new AI tools, and I will try them out and see how they work during my free time. And it feels like what I want to do for fun. So I do think that it's important to pick things that you enjoy doing, because success will lead to you just doing that more. You know, so if you don't like, you know, if you don't like analyzing data and you want to become some leader in the data space, just recognize you're just going to be analyzing more data when you get to be the leader in the data space. So maybe you want to reroute your career progression if you don't actually enjoy what it is that you're doing, since more of it is what's in your future. The other thing I would say is I've observed that trying to get to the deeper thing I am seeking in life has produced more balance. And that deeper thing for me is a sense of connection. I feel like impact has been the thing I've always described it as. But beneath that, I think there's this desire to feel connected, to feel a part of something, to feel... Yeah, I think that that's it. And so when I have come to that conclusion, all of the time flows into itself and feels like it's one and the same. So this is kind of an abstract concept. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it correctly, but...
No, I know exactly what you mean. I think of it as like a compounding effect, like interest, right? Like if you do something you're enjoying, the chances that you're going to do it more often, whether it's in your quote unquote work time or personal time, increases dramatically. And then by doing that, you get better, you build more skills, which leads to more success on your job. And then like it just compounds on itself, particularly over a course of years. And so it's one of those things where you don't feel like you're working all the time, although what you're doing is actually adding to your skill set and what you can actually do on the job. And so yeah, it just feels like living life, and it doesn't feel like work necessarily, right? You're not looking at the clock saying, oh man, I'm at the gym. I shouldn't be thinking about this right now. No one's quote unquote paying me. That's not really how it works.
Yeah, that's some of my best ideas at the gym, I would say.
There you go. There's science behind that, I think. I don't know. I'm just making
I think there is.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Well, is there anything else you want to leave our audience with before we wrap up today?
No, just some gratitude. Thank you so much for having me on. And I'm excited for what's next.
Great. Thank you so much, Lucia. Really great having you on the show. And yeah, let's keep in touch.
All right. Thanks.
If you enjoyed today's guest and you'd like to help support the show, please subscribe, leave a rating, and share this episode. As always, thank you to our listeners, and be sure to tune in to the next episode of Executive Runtime.